all I could think of was getting to the food. First, though, I had to stop being naked. Ayla slipped out as though it were perfectly all right to see me nude, but watching me dress would be indecent. The Arbran delegation had brought us bolts and cords and spheres. The four geometer races were more or less fascinated by the avowed, and might take it the wrong way if we attempted to hide what we were. Once I got properly wrapped, the hospital staff helped me don a backpack carrying a tank of Arb oxygen that was connected to the tube beneath my nose. Then I followed a series of pictographic signs to a terrace on the roof of the hospital, where I found Leo and Jessery elbow deep in their hampers. Frau Sildonik was there. With a resigned and hopeless air, he cautioned me not to eat too fast, lest I get sick. I ignored him as heartily as my fraws were doing. After a few minutes, I actually managed to lift my gaze from my bowl and look out at the artificial world around me. The four orbs of a given stack were so close that they almost kissed and were linked by portals, a little bit like cars on a passenger train. When the Dabin Urnud was maneuvering or accelerating, the portals had to be closed and dogged shut, but they were open today. Laterans lived in orbs 9 through 12. The hospital was in 10, not far from the portal that joined it to 11. This rooftop terrace, like all other outdoor surfaces, was intensely cultivated. A bit of space had been cleared for tables and benches. The tops of these, though, were slabs of glass, and vegetables grew in trays underneath. Bowers arched over our heads, supporting vines laden with clusters of green fruit. As long as one maintained focus on what was near to hand, it looked like a garden on Arb. But the long view was different. The hospital consisted of half a dozen houseboats lashed together. Each had three stories below the waterline and three above. Flexible gangways linked them to one another and to neighboring houseboats, which spread across the water to form a circular mat that seemed to cover every square foot of the water's surface. But because gravity here was a fiction created by spin, the surface, what our inner ears or a plumb bob would identify as level, was curved. So the circular mat of boats was dished into a trough. Our inner ears told us that we were at its lowest point. If we gazed across it to the other side, rather less than a mile away, our eyes gave us the alarming news that the water was above us. But if we were to make the journey blindfolded, it would feel like walking over level ground. We'd have no sense of climbing uphill. Of the orb's inner surface, about half was underwater. The remainder constituted the sky. This was blue and had a sun in it. The blue was painted on, but it was possible to forget this unless you looked at the portals to orbs 11 and 9. These hung in the firmament like very strange astronomical bodies and were linked by cable chair systems to houseboats below. The sun was a bundle of optical fibers bringing processed and filtered light that had been harvested by parabolic horns on the exterior of the icosahedron. The fibers were fixed in place on the ceiling of the orb, but by routing the light to different fibers at different times of day, they created the illusion that the sun was moving across the sky. At night, it got dark, but as Jules had explained, fiber pipes were hard routed to indoor growing facilities in the cellars of many houseboats, so that plants could grow around the clock. The system was so productive that these geometers were capable of sustaining a population density like that of a moderately crowded city solely on what was produced in the city itself. It was good, in a way, that the view from the hospital roof afforded so many remarkable things to look at and talk about, because otherwise the conversation would have been paralyzingly awkward. Leo's and Jessery's faces were stiff. Oh, they had cracked huge smiles when they had seen me, and I could not have been happier to see them. We shared those feelings immediately and without words. But then their faces had closed up like fists, as much as forbidding me to say anything out loud. We were eating too hard to talk much anyway. Frau Sildonik and another Arbran medic kept coming and going. And though I didn't wish to think ill of our Lateran hosts, I had no way of knowing whether this terrace might be wired with listening devices. Half of the Laterans were pro-pedestal. Even the pro-fulcrum ones, though, might not take kindly to the role we had played in assaulting the Dabin Urnud. Some might have had friends or relatives who had been slain by the Veilers. To divulge in casual conversation that a Thousander had breached the hull and then vanished would be the worst possible thing that could happen right now. Once I had sated my hunger a little bit, I began to get physically anxious about it. When Archibald showed up and made for his hamper like a piece of earth-moving equipment, I waited until his mouth was crammed before raising my glass and saying, "To Fra Jad, even as we think of the four Veilers who died, let's not forget the one who sacrificed his life in the first 10 minutes of the mission, before he even made it out of Arb's atmosphere." "To the late Fra Jad," Jessery echoed, so quickly and forcefully that I knew he must be thinking along similar lines. "I'll never be able to erase the memory of his fiery plunge into the atmosphere," Leo added with a patently fake sincerity that almost made me blow the libation out of my nose. I was keeping an eye on Archibald, who had stopped chewing and was staring at us, eyes abulge, trying to make out if this was some kind of extremely dark and elaborate humor. I caught his eye and glanced up. An old signal from Edhar, where we would, by a flick of the eyes at the Warden Regulance windows, say, "Shut up and play along." He nodded, letting me know he had taken my meaning, but the look on his face made his shock and confusion plain. I shrugged as a way of letting him know he was in good company.